Welcome to the Advanced Lab Testing Part 3 topic on advanced blood sugar testing. Before we get started, let's just go through our disclaimer that this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not intended as medical advice. It's intended as a sharing from my knowledge and the information and the research that I've done and the clinical experience I've had. And if you are under the care of a doctor, I encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based on my research and sharing with you, based on your own research and in conjunction with a qualified healthcare professional. If you are a health practitioner and are presenting information like this to your clients, make sure that you inform them that this is for educational purposes only. So let's review all of the blood sugar tests. Some of these we've talked about before in previous modules, and some of them we're going to introduce or go deeper with here. So the ones that we're going to talk about here are insulin, hemoglobin A1C, fructosamine, C-peptide, glycomark, anti-islet cell antibodies, anti-insulin antibodies, glutamic acid decarboxylase antibodies, ZNT8 antibodies, and tyrosine kinase antibodies. The ones that we've already gone over in the introduction to blood chemistry are fasting glucose, fasting insulin, triglycerides and HDL, and the importance of that ratio when it comes to blood sugar. We talked about hemoglobin A1C. We're just going to go a little deeper with it here. Then we talked about other tests that are related to blood sugar regulation, which would be like blood spot fatty acid, which is inflammatory markers, vitamin D, C-peptide, which we'll talk more about here, and then all the antibodies. Here are some of the lab markers, and we've gone over these before. We'll review them here. Where it says normal, that's actually the ideal, where we want it to be. Insulin resistance levels, metabolic syndrome levels, and diabetes levels. And some of these have similar levels to each other, and they're not absolute. Like if somebody has a glucose level in a certain range, it doesn't mean absolutely that they have or don't have a specific condition as indicated by these columns. So this is just some general guidelines for you. Here are some specific numbers that you might see in diabetes. Not uncommon to see these. 120 or 125, depending on whose office you're at, on two consecutive tests. Hemoglobin A1C greater than 6.5, triglycerides greater than 110, cholesterol greater than 220, HDL less than 55, and blood pressure increase. This is usual. Some of these may not be exactly there, but if you see someone with this pattern, generally you're looking at somebody with diabetes. Let's review these charts and then we'll get into some of the more advanced tests. So your normal blood sugar peak comes at about 45 minutes to an hour and then comes down. The insulin and C-peptide peaks about the same time, and the levels for a normal individual, someone without insulin resistance, without diabetes, actually we really don't want it going above 110 at that peak. That's where you're really ideal. And when you look at these ranges, yeah, the people in the lowest ranges are actually not going above the 110. And that's where we keep it steady and helpful. And we've reviewed in our other modules what happens when it goes above those numbers. And this was just a picture of a glucose tolerance test after 100-gram glucose solution. I'm not a big fan of the standard glucose tolerance test with the 100-gram glucose solution because it's just not something people are generally going to eat. Yeah, it will tell someone how badly they're going to fare if they eat a lot of sugar. But we're really looking for how is their body responding to the diet that they are most likely going to continue to follow. So that's where that top one is just uncontrolled diabetes. The red one, number 4, is actually a diabetic who's having reactive hypoglycemia. The pink one there, the number 2, is actually the mild diabetes. And then in the one in the range there, minimum and max, they're actually saying those are the normal ranges. The one down at the bottom is actually a normal range. The one at the top, the max, is actually more in the insulin resistance range in our standards. And if you're really looking to help people in a preventative way, to be proactive rather than reactive. So let's look at hemoglobin A1C. As you can see in the little picture, we have this situation where we've got a red blood cell and we have sugar. And in a high A1C, you can see a lot of these little purple sugar balls sitting on top of the red blood cell. In a low A1C, you see less. This is glycation. It's called glycation, and it's basically the sugar coating of the red blood cells. Makes them stiff, makes them sticky, and makes them more likely to damage blood vessel linings. It's the indirect measure of the average blood sugars over a 90 to 120-day period. See, the thing is that those blood cells, the lifespan of a red blood cell is 90 to 120 days, and you can't reverse glycation. Once you got sugar coating on those blood cells, it's not going to go away. The way that the hemoglobin A1C will come down is when those blood cells die off and new ones take their place. So if you're measuring hemoglobin A1C on a monthly basis, it's not going to really give you much indication of the person's progress. When the glucose gets to attach to the hemoglobin, like I said, there's some danger associated with it. When the levels of the blood sugar are high, this is what happens. The blood sugar goes and attaches onto the cells. Like I said, the glycation, the glycosylation, it's irreversible. You will only see a change after all those RBCs have replaced themselves. There are some things that influence the A1C, in which case you may not get an accurate assessment based on the A1C. When someone has conditions that cause them to have low red blood cell turnover, meaning that the red blood cells last longer, it could be an untreated iron, B12, or folate deficiency anemia. In a hemolytic anemia where there's blood loss, there is a high red blood cell turnover because they have to be replaced. And in chronic kidney disease and in the later stages of pregnancy, this also happens. So you may not get a really accurate measure with the hemoglobin A1C. It is a measure of long-term glucose control over the 90 to 120 days. When you should run this test is a number of reasons. Glucose is high or low. They're fasting glucose or the postprandial if you have them wearing a glucose meter or testing their own sugar, or they already have diabetes or insulin resistance and you're following up to see how they're progressing. I recommend that people run an A1C on a regular basis. We should get at least a baseline A1C on people as soon as they start getting blood tests on a regular basis, just to see where it is. And if we start to see it creeping up, then that's when intervention methods can happen rather than waiting for them to have full-blown insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, or diabetes. The optimal range, I like it between 4.5 and 5. So let's look at fructosamine. It's similar to A1C in that it measures glycation, but it measures glycation of proteins, including albumin, globulins, lipoproteins, and most of it is albumin. And it's basically indicative of long-term glycemic control, but not 3 to 4 months, more like 2 to 3 weeks, because those proteins get broken down and eliminated after 2 to 3 weeks. But so it's a really good measure if we're trying to see how well someone is sticking to their control. You can't really use it to screen for diabetes because there's some interfering factors, but it's really good once you have a baseline to monitor how well the person is keeping their diabetes or their blood sugar imbalance or insulin resistance or pre-insulin resistance under control. It has some issues where it may not be accurate in people with thyroid disease, with intestinal disease where they're losing proteins, in kidney disorders, in nephrotic syndrome, in liver disease, and where there's increased immunoglobulin levels, especially IgA, because remember that the proteins, they get attached to the proteins. And if there's increased immunoglobulin levels, we're going to see an increased fructosamine. So what are some of the ranges? Well, in somebody who's not diabetic with normal levels of albumin, 190 to 285, but if they have decreased albumin levels or increased albumin levels, it's not going to be that accurate. And with diabetics, it's usually between 210 and 563. That's a huge range. If we're going to use this thing as something that's useful to us, we want to be getting people in that lower end of the range. The normal range may vary a little bit between labs, and the levels do tend to increase with age. But if they increase with age, it's because insulin resistance increases with age. The destruction of the tissues increases with age. The dysglycemia increases with age. So I think that we really, as I think the albumin is really the only thing that we need to really be concerned about, that if the albumin levels are off and they're out of range, then those numbers may not be accurate. So what can cause abnormal fructosamine? Well, obviously it's in high, it's elevated blood glucose. When it's low, it could be that there's just low protein, right? There's not enough protein for these sugar molecules to latch onto. And so it's going to appear low. In obesity and pregnancy, oftentimes it's low as well. So we can't really often use it. We have to take a lot of things into consideration. That's why there's a lot of tests that we do, a lot of markers, a lot of touch points to make sure that we're really seeing how this person is faring. It's high, obviously, in elevated blood glucose, right? In dysglycemia, in insulin resistance, in metabolic syndrome, in diabetes. It can also be high from UV exposure, ultraviolet light exposure. It can be high in hypothyroidism, and it can be high when there's increased antibody production, because that's going to have more of those proteins, those globulin proteins in the blood. It can be high in iron deficiency anemia, similarly to how hemoglobin A1C can be high in iron deficiency anemia. It can be high in AIDS. And if a person is on glucocorticoids, steroids, right? Because those steroids are actually going to increase the level of blood glucose. So these are some of the considerations before you start running fructosamines and use them as markers. Let's look at insulin. This is another one of those tests like hemoglobin A1C and also fructosamine that most Western docs are not running on people unless they're already diagnosed with diabetes. These can be early screening. They're going to be much, much better than waiting for fasting glucose to go above 120. Because what we see is that even before, sometimes even long before that fasting glucose goes up, we see insulin go up. We see hemoglobin A1C go up. We see fructosamine go up. So we don't want to just, we don't want to just sit around and wait for people to get sick before we start testing this stuff. Let's catch it when it's at a danger zone and start to turn them around. Let's test it before it gets to a danger zone. So with insulin, the lab range is considered to be 2 to 19. 2 to 19 is very wide range, right? The ideal is found to be 2 to 5, and even 2 to 3 is better. That's fasting. Why do we need insulin when we're fasting? We don't. We just have a baseline background amount. We do have to be careful if we see it low. If we see it at the 2 or we see it at 1, I always like to double check to make sure that they're not a diabetic that hasn't been diagnosed yet that's going into pancreatic failure, or that there's some antibodies that could be attacking. We'll talk about the antibodies in a little bit. The ideal 2 to 5, 2 to 3 ideally. You take that fasting. My way of testing this is to send somebody to get 2 lab requisitions for insulin. They go to the lab fasting first thing in the morning. They go out to their car. They go and they eat a breakfast, and they eat food that is the highest glycemic meal that they would normally eat. No, we don't send them out to go get Coke. No, we don't send them out to go get Danishes. We go send them out to eat the highest glucose meal that they would eat. Not even something they would eat on a regular basis, but that they would consider eating. So I know someone who went in and did this, and when we went and did the postprandial after that, and so she went and ate sweet fruits. She went melons and pineapples. She had some sweet potatoes, and you know, she just ate a meal that would have been the highest glycemic foods she might normally eat, just to see that her pancreas could respond. Not something really yucky and bad for them, but something that might be, you know, especially if you've been working with this person for a while. If you haven't been working with this person for a while and they come in and they're on the standard American diet, you can have them go eat a really junky breakfast, right? But you tell them basically to eat the highest carbohydrate meal you would normally eat. 45 minutes to an hour later, we look at the postprandial. Usually peaks at an hour, 45 minutes to an hour. It depends on the meal, though. If it's a super high carb, like a concentrated sugar type meal, it might go up in a half an hour. If it's got more beans or things like that, and that take longer to digest, it may go up in an hour, 15 minutes, hour and a half. So typically when we're doing this, we have them go in, we do the fasting, we have them go in and do the postprandial. In any case, it should be at an hour, should be safe, because it's going to go up and we want to see how it goes up. if they start out in the low end of the range, and after their high carbohydrate meal, it doesn't go up much, then I'm concerned that there's some pancreatic failure. And at that point, I'm going to want to check some of the antibodies, and I'll show you that later. If it's a type 2 diabetic, somebody who's been type 2 diabetic for a long time, it could just be they've gone into pancreatic failure as a result of longstanding uncontrolled diabetes. Always want to make sure that it's not an antibody response, because there's different things we're going to do to help them correct it. Elevated postprandial insulin is actually one of the earliest biomarkers for identifying prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, and it also increased cardiovascular risk. And I gave you the link to an article that goes into a really good detail about that. So I've seen it all over the map. I've seen people go from 2 to 12. That's great. I've seen people go from 2 to 60. That's not so good. That's going to be somebody who has reactive hypoglycemia. I've seen people start with a fasting at 22 or higher, or 12, which is higher than we want, and then go up dramatically. So this is going to give you a really good idea about their glycemic control. Like everything else, there's some interfering factors. Obviously, if they're on diabetes medications, it's not going to be accurate, especially if they're taking insulin, obviously. You know, you can't really do this with any degree of certainty. With pregnancy in the second and third trimester, people do tend to have more elevated insulin. So you may or may not get the right response to that. Next, we're going to look at a couple of calculations that we can do with our glucose and insulin numbers to determine what the level of insulin resistance and insulin sensitivity is. So the first one is the HOMA-IR. And the way that we calculate it is take the fasting glucose in the U.S. units, and we multiply it by the fasting insulin in the U.S. units, and we divide that by 1,000. And the number we're going to get, ideally, is less than 1. So if you have a measurement that's in the standard international unit of glucose, you're going to take that number and multiply it by 18. The HOMA score gives us an indication of how much insulin is actually going to be needed to keep the blood sugar levels in check. And it's way more practical than measuring insulin resistance directly using the hyperinsulinemic euglycemic glucose clamp, which has actually, you need an IV and you're dripping in glucose and insulin, and it's very expensive, very invasive, and not practical. So this bodes well compared to that. The ideal range is going to be less than 1, and actually very much less than 1. So if we do a calculation and say somebody has a fasting glucose of 80, and they have a fasting insulin of 3. We're going to basically say 80 times 3 equals 240, divide that by 1,000, and we've got 0.24. They're great. Now let's just say we have somebody whose fasting glucose is 150, and their fasting insulin is 12, and then we divide that by 1,000, they're at 1.8. Greater than 1 is actually early insulin resistance, and 1.9 is full-blown insulin resistance. But that's what these are what the numbers are saying. In our regard, when we're looking functionally at this, I think it's better to consider the ideal range less than 1. Anything over 1 is in that earlier pre-insulin resistance stage. Anything above 1.9 is insulin resistance, and anything above 2.9 is really significant insulin resistance. So let's look at something else. It's relatively new. It was developed in the year 2000, so it's only been around for a little while, and it's called the Quickie. It's the Quickie Quantitative Insulin Sensitivity Check Index. It's a calculation that more so predicts the insulin sensitivity. The calculation is more complicated than the HOMA. The inverse of the sum of the logarithms of fasting insulin and fasting glucose. Okay, back to high school mathematics and logarithms, and most of us don't remember any of that. So there's calculators online that you can use it. And there's calculators for HOMA IR as well. So basically, we are going to be looking at this instead of the hyperinsulinemic euglycemic glucose clamp and the excellent correlation in all the studies that they've done with it. The range for this is between 0.3 and 0.45. And in this case, the lower is worse. So the closer to 0.45 is a normal level. 0.3 is closer to diabetic. So anything below 0.339 indicates insulin resistance and 0.3 diabetes. As we see people's levels decrease, it suggests that they're trending towards insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and diabetes. So there's these two calculations. You don't have to remember the formulas. Just put these on your toolbar on your browser so that you can calculate these whenever you have somebody who you have a fasting insulin and a fasting glucose, which isn't hard to get. And you can get a sense of how much degree of insulin resistance they actually have. Let's take a look at something else that's related to insulin, very closely related actually, which is C-peptide. And it's a peptide, a string of amino acids, that's released during the synthesis of insulin by the pancreatic beta cells. And for every one insulin molecule, we get one C-peptide molecule. There's something called proinsulin, and it's actually split apart, and it creates one C-peptide and one insulin. You can see that in the little picture there. It indicates how well the beta cells are making insulin, and it's done after fasting for 8 to 12 hours. The range is 0.5 to 2, and this is what we're looking for. Let's look at another test, which is called GlycoMark, another relatively new test. And it's measuring the excursions of glucose readings via a chemical called 1,5-anhydroglycerol, 1,5-AG. It's a monosaccharide, a single sugar, in nearly all foods that decreases when the glucose is above 180 milligrams per deciliter. And it returns back to normal in 2 weeks. So what this is measuring is spikes. Someone may have a pretty steady A1C, but they're having high and lows that even it out. So this is going to measure if they're having spikes. Personally, I don't think it's as useful as a CGM. But when people can't get a CGM, a continuous glucose meter, to actually look at their charts, or they're not able to really prick their finger often enough to really map out accurately, this is a good test to see if people are having spikes. Then there's a chart that shows the comparison between glucose A1C and GlycoMark. And there's a link, a couple of links that you can look at for more details on this. So let's drop into the blood sugar-related antibodies. Blood sugar-related antibodies are elevated, obviously, in type 1 diabetes. It's also elevated in something called LADA, latent autoimmune diabetes of adulthood. It's basically a type 1 diabetes that comes on later in life, and sometimes it's called type 1.5 diabetes. There are 5 antibodies. There's mainly, they talk about 4, but there's an extra one that's also valuable if you're looking for determination of the process and how far along it is. Glutamic acid decarboxylase is actually the most common in about 75% of all type 1 diabetics or autoimmune diabetics will have this elevated. There's also anti-insulin antibodies. There's also anti-islet cell antibodies. There's the zinc transporter autoantibodies and tyrosine phosphatase autoantibodies. So let's take a look at all these. So glutamic acid decarboxylase is an enzyme that catalyzes the conversion from glutamic acid, an excitatory neurotransmitter, into GABA, a calming neurotransmitter. And you may be wondering, well, what does GABA have to do with diabetes and insulin control and all that? Well, the beta cells in the pancreas, the ones that make the insulin, secrete GABA, and they need GAD to function normally. When we have antibodies that are attacking this GAD, they're also going to be attacking those beta cells, and they're going to cause some breakdown and some problem and autoimmunity here. So about 75% of people with type 1 diabetes have GAD autoantibodies in their bloodstream. Next, let's take a look at anti-insulin antibodies. These attack the insulin, and they're present in 55% of type 1 diabetics. Their prevalence correlates inversely with the age of onset of diabetes. So the earlier they took it on, the higher these levels are going to be. And it's usually the first marker in young children at risk for diabetes. The IgMs and the IgGs decrease the effectiveness of the insulin because they're attacking it. They're breaking it down. The IgEs in people taking insulin can actually result in allergic reaction at the injection site itself. Let's look at anti-islet cell antibodies. These are intracytoplasmic antibodies that attack the islet cells in the pancreas, and they cause damage to the islet cells, and it decreases their ability to make insulin. So the next ones we're going to look at are also going to be attacking islet cells, but they do it from a different standpoint. So the zinc transporter 8 antibody attacks the protein responsible for the uptake of zinc in the membrane of the insulin secretory granules in the beta cells. So still in the beta cells, right? 65 to 80% of children with recently diagnosed type 1 diabetes and 20 to 40% of adults with type 1 diabetes have antibodies to the zinc transporter. Finally, we have the tyrosine phosphatase antibodies. These are antibodies against a physiologic regulator of glucose homeostasis and energy balance. They attack this protein that regulates cytokine-induced pancreatic beta cell apoptosis. So we're going to get this positive in 50 to 75% of type 1 diabetics. So if we're going to be doing an autoantibody test, this can be quite expensive. So I wouldn't recommend that you just willy-nilly tell people to go get these things tested. Here's how I would go about it. If I'm suspicious that somebody isn't making enough insulin or that they are at risk of type 1 diabetes or LADA, is I'm going to, number one, test their fasting insulin and their postprandial insulin at 45 minutes to an hour after they eat their highest possible carbohydrate meal, highest one that they normally would eat or allow themselves to eat. We look at the difference. If their insulin levels don't go up after a high carbohydrate meal, then I'm suspicious that either they have pancreatic failure or that they have an autoimmune process that's getting in the way. So if that's the case, then I will generally pick one of the antibodies to run. Unless the person is, you know, their budget is high and they don't want to have to go back and forth to the lab, I'll pick the one that's most commonly going to be elevated, which is GAD. 75% of diabetics have it. So we do a GAD. If the GAD comes back positive, we know that they have an autoimmune process. We don't need to know all the others unless they want to know. If they have the budget to do it, you know, just run the full antibody panel. That's all there is to it. If not, then you can go through them sequentially and see what comes up. And that's it for the advanced glucose dysregulation testing, the blood sugar balancing testing. I gave you some links to ways to get insulin tested. Insulin can't be tested via a meter like the glucose can. I wish it could because it would give us so much great information. ZRT Labs has a test, a blood spot test. I ordered a couple of them a few years back with the idea that I ordered two and I was going to take one and then do the test, the glucose tolerance type test. They were $35 at the time, which is just a tiny bit more than it would cost you to get it tested in a lab, which is usually about $35, $25 to $35. We went back a few years later as I was recommending these to folks and found that they are only available at $70 each. So the price has skyrocketed. So yeah, it's inconvenient to go to the lab, get it tested, go to your car, eat a meal, and then go back and test it again. But that's the whole thing's going to cost you $70 to do that. The other option is to order the two ZRT test kits, though that'll cost you $140 to do the two of them and go from there. So either way, I've given you links to where you can find out more about those. And also there's some labs where you can do walk-in. Thank you for being here, and we'll see you in the next time.